Okay, hello everybody. Welcome to the bonus class. I'm really excited to be here tonight with a very special guest who I will introduce very shortly. Just to do a little technical soundproofing, can we all just please on our keypad press star 2 to let me know that you can hear me? So just press star 2 to let me know you can hear me, and then I'll proceed. And okay, looks like people can hear me. All right, so technology is working in our favor tonight, which is always a plus, and I'm happy, again, to introduce our special guest. I know I just want to say thank you to everyone for tuning in tonight because I understand that it's a weeknight, it's the middle of the week, and there's a lot of places where you could be, but I know a lot of you expressed great interest in being here tonight to not only continue our stress connection discussion, but to hear from an expert herself. So, without further ado, I'm honored and privileged to have award-winning researcher and best-selling author Donna Jackson Nakazawa with us tonight to help us really discern and decipher what the best self-care practices are, how they impact our health, and how we can begin to really implement them into our day-to-day life without feeling like, you know, we have to go to anti-stress camp, you know. I think Donna and I both have discussed that we really are passionate about bringing the self-care regime and the integrative health approach into a more basic flow of the everyday life that we all carry. You know, so we all have full-time jobs. We all have family that we take care of. So we got to be able to make sure we can manage all of these things and yet still take care of our health at the same time. So, Donna, hello. Thank you for coming. We appreciate you.
Oh, it's such a great pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me, Lisa. It's really lovely. And you know what a fan I am of you and your work.
Thank you. Thank you. So I'm going to give you guys just a brief background on Donna. So Donna, don't get bashful here, but I'm going to tell about you and all that you've done for the audience in case they haven't done some homework on you. So here's a little bit about Donna for all of you who are listening so you can get a kind of sense on how and why this is such a great opportunity to tune in tonight. So Donna's latest book is The Last Best Cure. I know a lot of you have heard me mention this. And in this book, she chronicles her year-long journey investigating groundbreaking neuroscience on how mind-body therapies such as meditation, yoga, and acupuncture awaken the healing potential of our brains, change our biology, and revitalize our cells and our health. Again, a lot of this we discussed last week in the stress connection. Along the way in The Last Best Cure, Nakazawa unveils a little-known branch of research showing the profound link between adverse childhood experiences and chronic illness in adulthood, a discovery that helped turn her own life around. And critics also call Nakazawa's storytelling art masterful and The Last Best Cure a genuine page-turning science nonfiction thriller that will not only change lives, it may even save some. And I know, Donna, I can personally attest to that. I've been your biggest advocate to all of my clients and all my friends and family. So kudos to you on this most recent book, which we'll discuss tonight. Donna is also the author of The Autoimmune Epidemic, which is how I first got introduced to her work. And this is an investigation into the reasons behind today's rising rates of autoimmune and related diseases. In The Autoimmune Epidemic, Nakazawa lays out the mounting evidence showing how our modern lifestyle, stress levels, chemical-laden environments, and 21st century diet have created the rightest possible conditions for today's autoimmune epidemic to take hold. So she's obviously a huge success in this field, and so we're really honored to have her. She's obviously really accomplished, and so we're just going to dive right into the good stuff here. Is that okay with you, Donna? Are you ready?
Yep, I'm ready for whatever wherever you want to go. I'm very excited to join in the conversation.
Okay, great. So a few things, Donna, that I do want to point out, and I know I've discussed this with you, but to the audience out there listening, I know we have a lot of people on the call and those who will listen to the replay. A few things that, you know, aren't included in your bio that I think are far more important about you and what draws me to your work is I think your unwavering commitment to the audience and the readers that you have to really provide as much of a holistic and scientific-based healing option and treatment plan for people. I think this is really unique for you, and there's a lot of research out there, but what makes you awesome is that you have a great way of connecting the science to personal stories and weaving them together very fluidly so that as a reader, you know, you're able to really understand how everyday activities like our morning routine, like eating meals at a regular time, adopting a stress routine, an anti-stress routine, is really groundbreaking for not only our cellular health, but our emotional health as well. So you're definitely a game changer, and I think you are, whether you meant to or not, you're definitely changing the face care of health. You're changing the face of healthcare as we know it. So, again,
oh, welcome. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. I think that for most of us who are health science journalists and who have, you know, studied both journalism and science, when it comes to our own lives and looking at the lives of our readers and patient groups we work with, it's a real comfort to us to be able to explain what is being observed by the researchers we work with and in laboratories, marry what we think we know to the science. And so whenever I'm able to do that and make it make sense in patients' lives, I feel really like it just solidifies many times what we already know. And I mm-hmm. think that's really true for the way you work, and it's true for the way I work. So it's always good for me in my own life to think about how the science underscores, verifies, and validates choices that I make to live a healthier life in every possible way, stress reduction, diet, everything, because it's motivating. To me, the science mm-hmm. is motivating, and I hope mm-hmm. it is to your listeners as well.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, a lot of people who I've worked with, you know, I think, like you mentioned before, we already know we should be doing a lot of these things, right? We kind of intuitively understand that we should be taking better care of ourselves and, you know, adopting better self-care practices. But some people, like you mentioned, you're motivated by science, and I've worked with a lot of people who really only listen to science. They're not interested in, you know, just listening to intuition. They want to know what study backs up what practice. And I think that's where you come in as really helpful to what I do and, of course, to everyone else who follows you, marrying the science. And then I think the intuition is really what makes your work dynamic. So, and absolutely, I've benefited from your work as well. So just to give you background on what we've done so far, this is like our last week of this 22-day sugar challenge. And I know people have made amazing strides and amazing connections to their, you know, to really upgrading their diet and, of course, their lifestyle. I mentioned this past week in our class called the Stress Connection that, you know, this is the hardest part. You know, the food seems daunting. Taking sugar out of the diet seems daunting. And it is in some way. But I actually think as I was telling the group this past week, Donna, that really understanding how to change our relationship to stress within our daily life is actually the most daunting of it all. Because I think, you know, we're really kind of hardwired to just kind of go, go, go and do. And we're not really, you know, taught as children how to reflect and take care of our mind and bodies. And I think, you know, changing a recipe, people can get over that and do that, but almost adopting a daily breathing routine, a yoga routine, 15 minutes a day of deep breathing, things like that are so powerful, but yet I think harder than food in some ways. Can you kind of attest to how difficult it was for you to kind of wrap your brain around really changing your lifestyle and how that was really difficult for you, maybe in the beginning?
Absolutely, and I would make one point and then I'll go into that, but my thought when you say that is that I think managing our stress on a day-to-day level is really important in terms of food, because often mm-hmm. we use food as that split-second equalizer as a way of sort of managing stress. And so the two are intricately tied, that when we're able to become more mindful and aware of how we're getting into stressful states and aware of how we can sort of settle the mind down, we also begin to change our relationship with food in that way as well. So you're mm-hmm. absolutely right. For me, when I first embarked on the journey that I took in The Last Best Cure, I was kind of, you know, really very aware of all the research on stress, and I thought that I did a lot of things to help keep stress out of my life. But once I started to understand what stress was and what it was doing on a biological level, the more that I engaged in stress states, the more I was damaging really my cellular health and vitality. Once I really understood those two things, the amount of time I was spending in stress states and the amount of damage those stress states were doing, it became pretty paramount to me to try to reverse those processes. And I just want to say, you know, what is stress? We hear that word so much, and we tend to think, I know what stress is. Well, you know what stress really is? It's so simple. Stress really isn't what happens. Stress is really our thinking. Stress is our thoughts. It's our state of mind when we're angry or full of regret or self-loathing or frustrated, or we have that self-lacerating voice in our mind that, oh, I ate that, or I did this, or I said that, or I can't believe I did blah, 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 that ruminating, fearful, afraid, or in pain state. And I noticed today on Facebook that women were saying, gosh, you know, I've been having a lot of that at night, of course, before you fall asleep, or, you know, for many of us on and off throughout the day. Well, what's so bad about this? I mean, shouldn't we be able to ruminate and focus on our problems? And, you know, if we're in a lot of pain, of course, we're going to be focused on the pain. It's distracting. But what happens is that over time, we begin to stay active in our sympathetic nervous system, which is something I call the stress now system, the SNS, and that causes stress neurochemicals to flood our bodies, which leads to inflammation that leads to disease. When we're able to walk away from stress states, which is, again, a state of mind, that ruminating, frustrated, self-loathing, fear, pain, we're able to step away from that. We're able to return to the state of homeostasis that nature really intended. And that is something called the parasympathetic nervous system, what I call the PER-NOW system. And that is a state of equanimity in which our body puts forth a very different set of neurochemicals. And those neurochemicals, not surprisingly, are really good for cellular health. They're good for our DNA, our telomeres, the ends of our DNA. So those are the two things I'd really start with, is that for me, those two basic understandings, what is stress and what was it doing, made me begin really an investigation. And that investigation led me to a kind of shocking view of how little time I was spending in a non-stress state.
Right, absolutely. Did you find that the moments when you would get in those moments of relaxation and those states of really taking care of the mind and body, was it then that you realized, wow, I have not been living like this for most of my life?
I really did. I had some times where it became very clear to me that I had been in such a state of pain, chronic pain, with my autoimmune conditions, that I was pretty much always on what I called the pain channel. And I write in The Last Best Cure that when I was on the pain channel, you know, it would be difficult for me to appreciate the sweetness of life right in front of me. For instance, I have two kids, and I had a moment once where I was braiding my daughter's hair, and I just smelled the beauty of this child in front of me, the fresh smell of her shampoo, and I braided her hair, and my fingers were focusing on the feel of her braid, and I realized that it was the first time in many days, that I had not been in a state of pain and fear over illness, worrying about, you know, different situations going on in my own life. And that was a really revelatory moment. Here I am having this, you know, beautiful child sit on my bed in front of me, braiding her hair, and I was finally on the Life Channel, and I knew that that was good for me. I just didn't know how to get on it more. I think most of us feel that way.
Yeah. But I almost liken it to, and I know we've talked about this, almost those moments of fully presence are almost like these aha moments where you realize, wow, is this possibly how I could be most of my life versus the other way around, it only being a glimpse. You know, I know for me, I've said this to people before, when I get myself to that yoga class or when I get to bed at the time that I know serves me best, I lay in bed or I'm laying on the yoga mat and I realize, you know, this feels so great. Why haven't I been doing this more consistently? And, you know, like you said, you intellectually understand the science. You know probably what should be done for you every day for the most part. It's this the next step, which I think is the application of really day-to-day changing our habits and changing, you know, the way we look at stress. And
absolutely.
I know that was a journey for you, right? I mean, that wasn't easy at first. I think you mentioned in the last episode really having to kind of every week almost kind of like come back to the game plan and what am I trying to do. And one of the things I did mention to the audience this past week was that you gave yourself, and as I remember in the book, three things that you were going to do every day. You know, they could have taken 30 seconds or it could have been 5 minutes or an hour of yoga or breathing or walking or mindfulness training, and you wanted to do just three things every day as part of your journey. So was that sort of like a really good marker for you to begin with, just focusing on three things? Because it can be overwhelming to change a lifestyle, right?
It is completely overwhelming to change a lifestyle. I think we'd all like to be able to, you know, get on a plane and run away to an ashram, but oops, you know, there are children to drive and dinners to cook and jobs, you know, with deadlines. And so my game plan was really wedded to the idea that it had to be, even in the midst of a busy, stressful, working mother's life. And I committed myself to trying, you know, to doing three things a day. Sometimes I did more and sometimes I did less, but I always came back to opening up the amount of time that I could find an entry into the Life Channel and step away from the Pain Channel. And for me, that process involved most certainly meditation, mindfulness, yoga. I added in acupuncture. But within each of those practices, there were a lot of different practices. For instance, mindfulness-based stress reduction has in that toolbox literally a dozen tools that I still use every day. In fact, I was working with my teacher last night for an hour and a half in our Sangha, a group of us come together once a week and meditate and work on our skills, because even now 2.5 years into it, I am always struggling to get back to that Life Channel, to that place where I'm producing good neurochemicals. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge life change. But the beauty of it is that with practice and time, the benefits are revolutionary. For me, they have been life-changing in that I am able to see the different things happening within my own mind. And an image came to me kind of yesterday as I was working in this group that, you know, it's as if now I have a traffic cop in my own mind that's able to say, well, hey, you know, maybe now you don't want to spend 20 minutes thinking about what your mom said on that phone call. You know, maybe, hey, let's go back to the breath. So once we begin to see the rewards of not engaging in stressful mind activities or stressful habits, whether it's food or staying up all night to watch some series that just came out in season 6 on Netflix, or, you know, all of these different choices that we make begin to add up into a different way of feeling, and the sweetness of that feeling feeds into a feedback loop where you keep picking it up over and over.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like just building momentum, right? You get that glimpse of, you know, braiding your daughter's hair and feeling like, wow, this is presence. This is pure joy. You mentioned, obviously, most of your journey was about getting your joy back. And once you have these moments again and again, the desire to implement them and the desire to implement more mindfulness-based training kind of gets stronger. Almost, I feel like fitness, right? Like where you work out once, it's really hard in the beginning, but then you just get this momentum where you can't imagine not doing it. Is it kind of the longer you do this, the easier it is in some ways for you, do you find?
Absolutely. And I would never say that it's easy because I am really someone who spent half probably what, well, if I'm lucky, will turn out to be half of my life in a stewing kind of brain just because of the things that had happened to me in my life. You know, when I was young, a lot of things happened. My father died unexpectedly, and there were a lot of family issues. And later, I was in and out of the hospital quite a bit, and one of my children had a very serious illness when he was young, and I've just been under a lot of stress for a very long time, and I think a lot of women can relate to that. And that adds up to a brain that just is a Velcro for the bad stuff. And to be in a place where I can literally walk outside, take my dogs on a walk, and begin to see the beauty rather than maybe possibly only notice it after 20 minutes of being outside, that's a big difference. And to be able to glimpse a place of stability and resilience within myself on a regular basis is good for me. It's good for the people around me. It's good for my relationship with my husband. It's good for my kids. And sometimes, which is, I guess, an odd sign of progress, I feel a little bit bad about who I was before. And then I have to be mindful of that as well.
Yeah. Well, they always say, I know we've talked about this before, and in obviously mindfulness-based training has its roots in levels of Buddhism and everything. But once you uncover, you know, the old sticks and stones, if you will, you start to realize what's been there all along and that maybe your habits have been, you know, affecting other people and affecting your life and your relationships and your work success for a long time. And then there's that habit, like you said, of feeling bad about what you used to do. It's the same with food. I tell people in the beginning, listen, when we start to take out sugar or gluten or whatever our topic is, you start to realize just how much you were eating it. And then you realize like, oh man, I haven't been healthy my whole life. And that's certainly not the way we want to have, you know, anybody think. But I think what we're getting at here is awareness can not only reveal deep insight and motivation, but it can also make you realize how ingrained habits have been for so long, you know, because of society or because of what's expected or because of how we were raised, you know. So it can be daunting to become aware of what, you know, you used to do in old habits, I think.
That's right. And I think that one of my big mantras is just the word forgiven. Today I was running around saying forgiven to myself in my head about a billion times because I did something really, really stupid physically that I shouldn't have done. And I pulled a muscle in my neck. And, you know, sometimes the disadvantage of starting to feel better is you start to feel you can do more and you forget. And I really was so mad at myself, and it just, to be able to come to a place where I was able to walk away from that fearful fretting of, oh my God, you know, I'll have to go in. Now I have to have an x-ray. I'll have to see the chiropractor. I'll have to do this. I'm not going to be able to talk to Lisa's group tonight. I'm in so much pain. To be able to just breathe into it, walk away from it, break it down, and not be in a state of self-loathing because here I am sick again. You know, all these things, whatever it is for me, I'm being very personal, but overlay that with whatever it is that's been bothering you today and to be able to step away from it, because really I think what we do is we develop a set of mental muscles, and those mental muscles, as you just said, are very similar to physical muscles, so that if you've been working out for a while, you know, you go into, say, a huge shopping center and the big doors are difficult for you to open, and then one day they're not. It's very similar what happens with the mind. It used to be very difficult for me to be the traffic cop in my own brain, and now it's not. It still requires work and dedication and daily practice, but it's not as difficult as once it was. And I will never be great at it, but I don't expect to be great at it. I just expect to live a little bit better quality of life, because I don't know. I don't find stress very fun. And I'll tell you a very funny story. I recently gave a talk at the incoming group of medical students at Hopkins, and they were kind of looking quizzical about this whole stress relationship. It was their first week or two in med school, and how they were going to bring it up with their patients and how they were going to wrap this into their practices 4 or 5 years down the road once they're newly branded doctors. And I asked them all if they were very likely over the next week or so, when they were really stressing out over their first paper that was due and their first set of exams, if they were likely to go sit in a quiet place after walking in nature and breathe quietly for 15 minutes and then possibly do a downward facing dog on a yoga mat, or if they were going to go sit somewhere, eat a cheeseburger, some french fries, and chew on their nails and scream at themselves in their heads about how they didn't even belong to be, you know, belong at Hopkins Med School. Mm-hmm. And that room of 350 students, they were laughing hysterically, because here they're thinking, how am I going to use this with my patients? How am I going to be this great new doctor? And they realize they have no practical expertise here, because not one of them would use it for themselves. So
that's amazing. And did they give you any feedback, or did you get a sense of like you said, like they realized, well, you know, they could benefit from this practice as well and become better practitioners as well?
I think that's the movement in medicine, I'm happy to say. And that's actually why they were there having this conversation, because there is a great recognition in medicine that we're going to have to really understand the relationship between stress and disease. And we have that understanding in the lab, the very close relationship between rising levels of stress hormones and what they mean in the body. Now, it's interesting. There is a lot of new research out about stress, and some of it's pretty interesting. So I don't know if you and your listeners want to go into that or not.
Yeah, absolutely we do. What I would like to do actually is come back to two points we've been making that I think really will hit home for everyone listening, and I know myself, is the concept of forgiveness you've mentioned in your book and also today, that, you know, when you have the mistake, let's say you hurt yourself, or for the listeners out there, they have the piece of food they're really not meant to have. Maybe it's a cupcake or a cookie or a latte. And, you know, that obviously isn't maybe the best option. But what happens after we eat the food, or we injure ourselves, or we make a mistake, is far more damaging than the actual act itself. So I think a lot of people out there, I try to tell them when they call me and when I consult with people, and they say, I haven't had a good day of eating, you know, and then they spend the next half an hour ruminating and being upset about it. And I try always to tell them, like, you know, it's, you just have to let it go. You know, it's done, it's over with. But what we can do right now in this moment is breathe through it, forgive yourself, move on. And I think that can create a more positive effect than, obviously, you know, you can't fix what happened in the past. But I think it'd be great for you to just kind of mention, like you said before, this concept of forgiveness and how powerful that can be, and how it's so much healthier to just move on from a mistake, if you will, than to ruminate over it. I know that's a very common human practice for us. So that's one thing I wanted to mention.
Well, I think that's a really great point. And I would say that one thing that I found in my own journey, and also in the research and for many, many different patients with whom I've worked, is that until we really have some compassion toward ourselves, we probably aren't going to change all that much. And there's a good reason for that, because it requires compassion to the self to engage in the things that make us feel better. If we can't forgive ourselves, if we have accustomed ourselves, as so many of us have in Western society, perhaps all of us, to this voice that we have to do it better, faster, we haven't done enough, we aren't pretty mm-hmm. enough, thin enough, smart enough, successful enough, we weren't the kid growing up who got it all, or maybe we did, but it wasn't, you know, what our parents thought we should have done. That voice of criticism is so ingrained, and I know that I found for me in my mm-hmm. journey that it was much more deeply ingrained than I could ever have imagined. And mm-hmm. until I dealt with that, and I think it is true for all of us, it's very hard to change, because why would you change for someone you don't like?
Mm-hmm.
Why would you change your habits of eating, your habits of staying up all night and watching TV and feeling washed out the next day? Why would you want to help someone if you're not on their side?
Absolutely.
So it's absolutely critical to have the compassion toward yourself so that you wake up on your own side. And for mm-hmm. me, that was really revelatory, because I assumed that I liked myself. I assumed that I was on my own side.
Mm-hmm.
And the recognition that I was constantly beating myself up about every habit under the sun, every stressful thought, having been sick for so many years, the list could go on and on. That was something I really had to deal with, and that is how my mantra became forgiven, because
I
needed to get to a place where I could easily forgive myself so that I could get to the things that I wanted to do to feel better. And what's interesting about that is once you start to build that feedback loop of better habits and you're waking up on your own side, the whole thing, as we said before, begins to build on itself.
Right. I love it. I just was making a note here as you were talking, this concept of cultivating self-love. And I know, going back to the diet and the eating regime, which is what most of us have been working on the past 22 days, is that, like you said in the beginning, the more stressful of a relationship we have with the life events around us, with ourselves, with everything going on, the more we're going to rely on food. And when a lot of people come to me, whether it's health concerns like binge eating or, you know, compulsive eating, things that are really hard for them to control, it really all boils down to the relationship we have with ourselves. You know, if we love ourselves and we're rooting for ourselves and we want to be our own best coach, we're often not going to be inclined to make those decisions to, you know, eat the sleeve of Oreos or whatever it may be. We're going to make better decisions and more manageable decisions for our health, you know, before and after we eat meals. And like, I think what I would just want to reiterate for everyone out there listening, this is why I always try to let you know that I, too, am not perfect, and I don't desire to be perfect with my diet. I really desire a balance that works for my body, and I know, Donna, you feel the same way. And I think this draws me into my next point of this black and white approach that people have with food and with health. And to give the audience a little bit of context, Donna, with what you have been with, you know, I haven't gone into your specific health concerns. Obviously, that's something you can mention if you want. But is there a way maybe you can give the audience a little bit of insight on how difficult life was for you before you adopted this year's journey of, you know, getting your brain and your body and your joy and your life back? What were some health concerns you were facing? And then the second part of the question is, you know, when you started on this journey, can you mention how perhaps it wasn't about curing everything as much as it was just having a better quality of life and enjoying life again, beyond the diagnosis of whatever the doctor mentioned to you? Can you talk about that briefly?
Yes, those are great questions. So on the first, you know, as I started the journey and as I write about in the book, really for me I had been in and out of the hospital for a period of about a decade, twice with a very serious condition called Guillain-Barré, which is paralysis of the arms and legs. The second time I was paralyzed, I was in bed for the better part of 6 months and really not walking normally again for almost a two-year period after that. And even then, left, as so many people who have had Guillain-Barré multiple times are, with a very severe kind of flu-like condition, a fatigue that is like the day that you start to feel that the flu might be lifting, mm-hmm. but every day. So that for me, just getting up the stairs was often, hey, here are 4 stairs, sit down, take a break, get up the rest. And it was nothing for my kids to see me lying down at the top of the stairs and just step over me. Hey, Mom, need anything? That was really completely normal in our house, mm-hmm. and kind of just the way things were. And that made me realize, you know, how much I was missing with my family and watching my kids grow up. And I could get it together and get on an airplane and go lecture somewhere and pretend to be a lot better than I was. However, the toll it was taking on me was enormous. And so that's pretty much where I was. And in terms of going on the journey and making that effort to get my joy back. So tell me where you want me to go from there.
So, you know, a lot of times people come to me or in my practice and they'll say, like, you know, I want to heal my disease. I want to reverse it. And, you know, I'm the eternal optimist. I always believe we can reverse everything. But what I want to kind of have you touch upon is that your journey with the Last Best Cure and your journey now wasn't necessarily to reverse every disease. It was really more of a finding your middle ground, finding your joy of daily living.
Right, right. And that's exactly right. So that when I came to the end of my year, a lot of things had changed for me, and some of them quite remarkably. I found myself going from a point where I wasn't able to walk across a room in a straight line, kind of like that drunk driver test, heel toe, heel toe, mm-hmm. to being able to do that back and forth across the room a million times. I could get up and down the stairs without that kind of terrible fatigue. I could ride a bike again. There were mm-hmm. so many changes in terms of my day-to-day life that when I went back to my doctor, who had taken 17 vials of blood before my journey and 17 vials after my journey just to see how things differed immunologically for me, the changes she found were really profound. And I had not taken any medications. I had simply used my mind as my medication, my mind as my medicine. And those changes were profound. Having said that, although the book is called The Last Best Cure, really it's about healing. And when we are healing, we may or may not get to a place where we feel like we're 18 again and can run marathons. The truth is I'll probably not run again. Running was out for me before I took my journey, and it was out for me after I took my journey. However, for me, the changes that occurred are life-changing because mm-hmm. a certain amount of healing happened in my heart and my mind that allowed me to reclaim a quality of life that allowed me to feel really good about what I had. So not only did I make progress physically, but the emotional and mental progress I was able to make helped me to appreciate those physical gains so greatly that the fact that I can't run and still have some physical limitations, it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because like you mentioned in your book, you're able to move up and down the stairs. You're able to walk in a straight line now, all the things that you weren't able to do for many years. And I think that this is kind of where a lot of people who are listening you know, it's easy to be black and white with health, with life, right? We either want success or we have failure. We either eat all the good foods or we eat all the bad foods. This is what a lot of people mention to me, is that they live in a state of black and white, or a state of extremes. And I think what you're saying and what I have been saying over the course of this, the sugar detox, is that we have to find our middle ground and we have to find a way to just improve our quality of life, so much so that it keeps the ball rolling and we keep going on this journey. You know, I this is part of the reason I said in the beginning of this course that this is obviously we're addressing sugar and sugar consumption, but sugar is always going to be there until we're all 100 years old, right? It's just about finding your balance with it and making sure it doesn't own you and improving our quality of life. So, you know, that's amazing. And also, too, you know, for those of you who have not read the book, The Last Best Cure, I highly encourage you to go get it, like, tonight. and you read it. But you mentioned, Donna, that also scientifically your blood work, not only could you walk in a straight line and walk up and down the stairs and ride your bike for the first time in many years just because of your self-care regime that you implemented, but your blood work was also drastically different to the point where your doctors couldn't even believe it, right?
Absolutely, and she still can't. So for the first time in years, I began to produce normal red blood cells. I have a lot of issues with my red and white blood cells being produced in my bone marrow, and the ability had been missing for a long time for my bone marrow to produce normal red blood cells and a normal white blood cell count. And so to see those changes for her, that was really quite dramatic. And again, I would reiterate everything that you said, that just as with food, it isn't that there aren't days where I don't still have some of those old feelings of fatigue. How I would describe it is that I've gone from 7 or 8 bad days and a good afternoon, and then 7 or 8 bad days and another good afternoon, to 7 or 8 good days and a bad afternoon. And I think that's kind of what we're trying to do with food. I eat a gluten-free, dairy-free, everything-free diet, and I have for many years. However, you know, I have found some pretty good mint chocolate chip coconut ice cream with agave.
Yeah, I think I know what brand you're talking about, too. Yep.
And I can still be that 22-year-old girl who sat down in front of a really good TV show, like, let's just say, The Good Wife, and make my way through a good portion of that little tiny, it seemed tiny, thing of ice cream as it went down. So so it isn't that that hasn't gone away. It's that the next day I know how to do it differently. I know how to get back on the plan. I might be traveling and not meditate for days. I might be around a person who I find particularly difficult or toxic, and find very quickly that it is as if I have never done any of this work with my mind and my stress, my ability to be mindful with stress, done it at all. But you know what? I come back faster to the right place. And it's an interesting sort of analogy that in the study of mindfulness, we really know that the most important part of the practice is not our kind of zen moments where we feel one with the cosmos and the most important part of the practice in terms of our neural structure is the moment we recognize we went off the path. The moment we recognize that our mind is ruminating or spinning stories or getting hung up on some old tape, we catch it and we come back to the path. That is the most important part, I think, of almost any health practice, because that right there is where we build the muscle that begins to change the habit.
Absolutely.
So it isn't what you ate. It's that you recognized, without beating yourself up, hey, that's what I ate. And tomorrow, I think I'll make my kale smoothie and have some mineral bone soup.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's really important for people to hear from someone else. The group has been hearing me say similar things this whole time. But what I think is most profound, what you're saying, and I know you and I have talked about this, is that these moments of falling off the path, if you will, or, you know, falling off the roadmap of health or diet, you know, that's not the bad part. It's actually, I think, a blessing, like you're mentioning, because it strengthens our ability to come back to really what our goal is and what our path really is. And you find that, like you said, over time, year and year go by, and those times where you come off the path or you veer off the path are less and less, and they don't feel as good anymore. So you begin to just create a true lifestyle transformation, I think, and that's the journey that I keep stressing to everyone, is that this 22 days is meant to change habits and to change thinking about food, but it's meant to really jumpstart you to make it a lifestyle transition, which takes time, obviously. It takes a little bit of practice, but that's a really great point. I hope everyone is writing that one down. It's actually a good thing to come off the path because it strengthens your ability to keep coming back and back and back to your goal and to what you're trying to do.
If it's worth anything to your listeners, I've been gluten-free for 7 years, and I still go off because I'm convinced it won't matter. And I think this past August may be the last time I do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was not a good plan. So
yeah.
the more that I have been off gluten and dairy, then as you said, when I am on them and I see how I feel,
mm-hmm.
why do I want to keep doing that to myself? At a certain mm-hmm. point, I've gotten to the point in my life where it just really isn't worth it, and I almost associate the food with the feeling before mm-hmm. I eat the food, so that
yeah.
I stop craving the thing that I might have said 5 or 6 years ago I would never stop craving. You know, I was in France with my son, and, you know, those baguettes are delicious. But right mm-hmm. now, if I saw one again, I wouldn't touch it because I would associate it with that terrible, yuck, draggy feeling
mm-hmm.
that I have afterwards. So you start to build those associations as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a positive, healthy thing. You know, it's, like for everyone out there listening, it doesn't mean that when you're in France, you may not, you know, when in Rome, you may not just enjoy the moment. But,
right.
It'll just become less and less, and I think that's not a scary thing. It's, you know, they always say that when the desire to change becomes stronger than the desire to, do you remember that quote? I'm like blanking here on the end of it.
Someone no, I know what knows, you're. But, I know what you're referring yeah. to, though. I know what you mean. It's just you begin to kind of taste the sweetness of what it's going to feel like not to do the thing that you want to do. And
right,
that
right.
feels better to you than the sweetness of doing it. And that's just a moment we all hit at different times and in different places.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think sugar is the hardest one of all.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, you've discussed this and I've mentioned this, is that we're just hardwired for it. It's not abundant in nature. You know, so from an evolutionary standpoint, just like stress, we're hardwired for stress and evolution. We are hardwired to indulge and to overeat the foods that are rare in nature. And foods that are rare in nature are sweet things, salty things, and fatty things. You know, if you look back at the diet thousands of years ago, it wasn't very indulgent. You know, it was pretty bare bones and pretty much for survival. So, you know, anyway, I won't get into that too much right now, but...
No, it's interesting, though. I told you, I love the science.
Yeah. Well, it's just, I think it makes people feel better. Kind of, I think, lets us off the hook in realizing we're not bad. We're not weak. We don't have, you know, our willpower is not the concern. It is not a matter of willpower, as Kelly McGonigal talks about in some of her TED Talks and her actual books. It is really a matter of understanding how we're wired as human beings to exist with stress and with food, and realizing that the society that we live in right now is the perfect storm for everything to make us, like you said in the last cure, to drive us down a state of chronic disease. You know, we are surrounded with choices that have never been here, should not be here, and, you know, are causing rampant chronic disease. One of I've mentioned this on Facebook a few times, but a quick quote when I was at the conference for functional medicine weeks ago in Portland, one of the doctors, Dr. Alex Vasquez, said, you know, chronic disease is sustained disease, so let's stop sustaining it. And I think there's a lot of truth in that in terms of what's around us as quick fixes, and it's very easy to get stressed because everyone around us is doing it. So we can talk about just stop sustaining, you know, the chronic migraines, or, you know, the IBS or the autoimmune condition. We can work on stop feeding it, if you know what I mean, just every day taking a couple dietary or lifestyle upgrades to stop sustaining that chronic disease. And I think that's what we've been trying to do the past 20 days, and obviously with now the stress connection coming in. So, yeah, we're working to stop sustaining it. I think that's our goal.
I think that's a great quote, and I like it a lot. I think that we all are doing things to sustain some of our symptoms at the same time, and I think you and I agree on this. I know we have talked about it before. That's in no way to say that we're responsible for our disease.
Right.
There's a very different
right.
thing, and I always caution the patients I work with that, you know, we can't get caught up in the idea that, well, if going gluten-free, dairy-free, sugar-free, everything-free, and meditating 15 times a day, although that would be way overkill, you know, doesn't clean up my psoriasis, multiple sclerosis, fibromyalgia, migraines, then, you know, I haven't done it well enough, or now it's my fault, or I should have tried harder. Not at all. This
mm-hmm.
is all
mm-hmm.
about taking out the analogy that I use, is that our immune systems are really like barrels. They can hold so much without spilling over. They can hold a lot of stuff that's not supposed to be in the water supply. They can hold a lot of stuff that's not supposed to be in the air we breathe when a diesel truck goes by in front of us as we're crossing the street. They can hold a lot of stressors in modern society where we live almost as if we're cats surrounded by barking dogs, where everything is seemingly life-threatening, from the bill that comes in the mail to the car that cuts us off on the freeway to the exam we have to take the next day to the fight we had with our you know, someone we love, our spouse or partner. And they can handle all of these things, stressors, food toxins, the food we ate that wasn't organic. But at a certain point in modern society, in this perfect storm of toxins, stressors, and lifestyle habits, that barrel, just that tiny little drop at the top, we've all seen it, that one drop, and the water starts to spill over. So
mm-hmm.
our job, the way I see the let's not sustain it, is that let's see what we can take out of the barrel. We all
mm-hmm.
owe ourselves that. To use makeup that doesn't have phthalates and parabens, to see what we can do with the piece of toxicity that we're actually inflicting on ourselves through our mindful habits, the toxicity we may be inflicting on ourselves through some of the food choices we have that are not recognized by the body as food sources, but as foreign to the body, which activates the immune system. So if there are lots of things that activate the immune system in negative ways and prick up the immune system to become overreactive, which leads to inflammation, which leads to disease, well, then really, if we're on our own side, if we believe in self-care, and if we don't want to sustain that inflammation, which causes disease, then we want to step back and take things out of the barrel that are disease-sustaining. It doesn't mean we're going to be perfect. It doesn't mean it's our fault if we still have a chronic condition, but there is
right.
no doubt but that we are going to feel better.
Yeah, it's almost like we're, you know, like it's almost like the quote should be, let's stop exacerbating it. You know, let's do what we can to find our middle ground and find our balance. That's a great perspective. One other thing I want to mention that is kind of a question that someone posed today on the Facebook message board. I know that there are a few people on the call who wanted to ask questions and wanted to talk to you, so we're going to leave a little bit of time for that. But one person mentioned how difficult it can be with our to-do list, with our jobs, and many people here have multiple jobs, to really make stress management a priority. And I think this is interesting because I know we've talked about this in terms of, and we've talked about it tonight, is really making, you know, mindfulness-based training, what I'm going to do for everyone listening is I'm going to send out some information on mindfulness and what that is and where you can tune into some of the best reads and some of the best videos out there, because, you know, it's great to keep learning about that. But how do we make stress management a priority and kind of weave it into our day-to-day? I think, you know, it's important that we don't think of it as a to-do list thing, but that we make it part of our life. So I like to tell people that, you know, I've done a 10-day silent meditation retreat in Taiwan in the middle of nowhere on a mountainside. You know, I've been there. And it was 10 hours of meditation every day. Couldn't talk, couldn't stretch, couldn't do yoga. It was just straight mindfulness-based meditation. It was super intense. But I wouldn't say that 10 days was the backbone of my practice. I think what's the backbone of what I do to maintain mindfulness in my life isn't on a cushion. It isn't in a meditation class. It's when I'm washing the dishes. It's when I'm cleaning the apartment. It's when I'm trying to be mindful and I just do, you know, 20 steps of mindful walking where I just kind of feel my feet on the ground. I listen to my breath and I become present. And so I think for me, that is the most powerful thing about making stress management a part of our life, is that it becomes, every once in a while, like you're saying, you just kind of tune back into the breath. And you could be washing the dishes and you could be a stress ball, or you could be washing the dishes and paying attention to how the water feels on your hands and the soap in the sink and the dishes that you have in front of you, you know? So I think I like to pose it like that. I don't know if you want to add on to that, but I know that was a concern for a few people.
I completely second everything that you said. And one of my teachers joked with me that I should write a book called How to Multitask Meditate.
You will be the one to do it, Donna.
I really have it down. And for me, walking the dogs is a chance to meditate. And as you said, you know, washing the dishes, so many different times where just sitting at a red light I won't close my eyes because I don't want to get honked at, but, you know, just half closing my eyes and taking in three breaths and letting them go. I come back to my breath all day, every day, all day. It's imperfect, but it really beats escalating my own stress level. So there are days where you just aren't going to be able to sit down and take half an hour. One thing that I have traded out, I know that you do things like, you know, well, let's trade out this for this at breakfast. And I'm a big believer in little trade outs because they add up over time. And one of my trade outs is instead of listening to the news at night or a TV show or some such, I listen to a Dharma tape from one of my favorite Dharma teachers. And there are thousands of free Dharma tapes through an organization called Dharma Seed. I also give to that foundation because they do, you know, suggest that if you listen a lot, kind of like NPR, really, you know, that you donate. And I belong to a sangha that helps to support them. But you can download through Dharma Seed. There's an iPhone app. You can download Dharma Talks. And there is nothing more delightful to me than getting into bed at the end of the day, doing a little 10-minute meditation and listening to a Dharma talk. And I once told one of my teachers how bad I was that I wasn't doing that 6:45 in the morning. I was too busy then. And there I was falling asleep during my meditations. And she said, whatever it takes, however you work it in, because slowly one day you might be able to work it in even more of a way. But the worst thing is to give up because you think that you don't have time.
Right. I think also, too, I've mentioned this to people, you know, it's not about having time. It's about, again, making time and weaving these things into our day-to-day practice. I think that's the most powerful thing is the mind will always come up with excuses as to why we don't have enough time or money or resources. But I think it's about, like you said, every moment is a chance to meditate because every moment you can come back to the breath. And even if you come back to the breath once in 60 seconds, you know, that's once more than perhaps we did a year ago. So I think it's just about building and building and building so that things become fluid and like you're finding, certainly not easy per se, but a whole lot better than they used to be with regards to
And I would underscore that everyone needs training for these things. It's really easy, mm-hmm. you know, to hear people talk about them. Here, Lisa and I are, you know, talking about being mindful, doing the dishes. If I had heard that 2 years ago, I would have possibly been laughing my head off, you know, because
yeah.
I wouldn't know how to do that. I wouldn't even begin to know how to get rid of all of my planning and scheduling and thinking about what more I had to do the rest of the day while I was washing the dishes because I wouldn't have the skill set or the training to do it. So I wouldn't want anyone to think, wow, that just sounds like something I wouldn't even know how to begin to do. Most of us who have learned how to do it have learned the same way we learned anything else in our lives. Like any skill you can think of, somebody helped us. So that's mm-hmm. why I'm a big believer in getting into classes or courses. The mindfulness-based stress reduction course has actually just added an online component, which I think is really exciting.
Okay, great. So one thing I'm doing, everybody, and I'm just going to send this out in the email following up to this call, is not only the replay, but I'm going to include a list of online resources that everyone can access. Most of them are free. I know, Donna, you mentioned podcasts and things like that. If you have any else you recommend besides the ones that I send along in the email, let me know. But I want to just definitely give everyone the opportunity to, once this call is over, to figure out how we can make these practices, you know, available to us, whether it's an in-person class or an iPod or an iPod class. So I'm going to include that for the email tonight, just as a FYI. So thank you again, Donna, for everything. What I want to do right now, because just as a matter of time, I know that there are a few people on the call who wanted to pose questions to you and talk to you a little bit about your journey. If you're on the call right now and you're listening via phone or even via Skype, if you can just press star 2 on the keypad and I can call on you and we can address your question. So if you can just press star 2, that will be great. Okay, so we have two questions. I'm going to go with Stephanie first in Connecticut. Stephanie, if you just press star 7, you can talk.
Hello?
Hey.
Hi, how are
Hi.
You? Hi. Hi, Donna. First of all, I just wanted to say thank you so much for being on the call. I have not read your book yet. I intend to get it. My boss, Annalisa, speaks so highly of it that it sounds amazing. So it's definitely on my list to get. And I just wanted to say, just listening to you tonight, it's been very eye-opening, and you've definitely been an inspiration to me just from hearing just the small tidbits that you've talked about right now and just have really kind of given me hope again that, you know, your mind is very, very powerful, and it's definitely one of the important things in anyone's healing journey. But I just wanted to ask you a quick question. I mean, I think you may have answered it, but if you have any other tips, I would just love to hear it. So I know one of the things that I think I took away the most from tonight was forgiveness, you know, forgiving yourself, not beating yourself up over little things and just, you know, staying on track and knowing when you, you know, go off the wagon. But I think one of the hardest things for me is going out to eat. So, you know, I've been on this a healing journey for about 3 months now, and, you know, I was on, you know, no gluten, no dairy, no this, like completely eliminated a ton of stuff from my diet, and I find sometimes I've worked so hard for the past 3 months to get to where I am that, you know, sometimes, like, I still want to go out and enjoy, you know, going out with friends or whatever it may be. And I find myself sometimes getting anxiety, for lack of a better term, to going, you know, when we want to go out to eat, because I just don't know kind of how to handle it. And I kind of get stressed in those situations because I'm not sure, like, I don't know what to eat. I don't know what the restaurant's going to be like. And, you know, I almost get in like in a panic state. So I just wanted to know if you had any tips on that, or what, you know, what do you focus on eating when, if and when you do go out, and how do you, you know, manage that, you know, I guess like stress level and trying to balance that in your life?
I think that's such a great question, and it's something that comes up for me a lot in my personal life, but also with the patients I work with if I'm doing chronic illness coaching or working with an advocacy group. When patients have chronic conditions, going out to eat can be a nightmare. They might have IBS or ulcerative colitis or rheumatoid arthritis condition that's worsened by certain types of foods. And also there's just the whole stress of when you're not feeling well and you're out of the home eating, are you going to come home and feel sick? A lot of people with weakened immune systems go through what you're talking about all the time for different reasons. So the first thing I would say is that there are a lot of people who face a kind of anxiety with eating out because of food allergies. By the way, my daughter is allergic to peanuts and nuts, so we go through this every time we step foot in a restaurant. Oh, we're every waiter's dream. I'm gluten and dairy free. She's peanut and nut free. And by the time, you know, they basically grilled everyone in the kitchen, they wish we would just get up and leave. But there is an anxiety about it. I've had it on behalf of myself, and I've had it on behalf of my child. And for myself, it's not just, are there going to be foods I'm going to react to, but because of some of my immunological issues, I also have fears about, you know, is this going to be, you know, good, clean food? Is it in any way going to be, you know, possibly have any kind of bacteria in it that could make me sick? Because there are a lot of foodborne pathogens in restaurants at a much higher rate than we encounter in our own homes. So you're not alone. One thing that I always talk to women about who bring this issue up with me is part of this really depends on the friends that you're going with. Because I think that when we're really close with people and we're able to tell them about a journey that we're on, whether it is a food allergy, a food intolerance, or a discomfort level regarding a restaurant because of, you know, how pure and clean and organic the food might be. I think when we're with friends who really care about us, they want to see us succeed, and they might be more accommodating to your concerns than you are aware. So I just throw that out. Because I think for me, if I say to my friends, I don't really know if I want to go to that restaurant because I know they don't really accommodate gluten, dairy-free, or what have you, or Claire can't eat there, usually people are pretty understanding. So that's the first thought that comes to mind. And the second is that when you choose restaurants carefully, you can usually find some pretty amazing and delicious things to eat and feel that you've indulged yourself pretty well. And on that, I would kind of also add, if you go off the path, so to speak, really, it's okay. I mean, I think it's okay. We should ask Elisa, but I've been known to get halfway through a gluten-free double chocolate cake at Woodbury Kitchen, which is this amazing restaurant we have in Baltimore. And I'm okay with that because, you know what, I'm probably not going to do that again for a while. I'm probably right. not going to mm-hmm. do it again tomorrow. So those are all thoughts that come to mind, and being able to talk yourself through those things and walk yourself through those things and breathe a little, it's really important to manage the anxiety piece of it, because sometimes we might eat more things that we don't want to eat because we're feeling anxious. So those are lots of thoughts jumbled together, and I hope something in there is helpful.
No, no, absolutely. And, you know, and I think that was kind of led to my next question is, like, you know, what's your idea of moderation? You know, one of the things I think that I struggle with, you know, I can tell you I have been out to eat once since this past July. So I'm like, when I get on something, I'm like very regimented, and I have that fear, and that's where the anxiety comes from, that, you know, if there's one, like, little slip-up, like, even if, you know, if it's so minuscule that it's going to set me back, and I, you know, I wouldn't want to do that. And, but I know that, you know, people say, like, within moderation, you know, what's your idea of moderation? Is it, you know, kind of just, I guess, I know everyone's different. I don't want to say, like, once a month or once every quarter or something like that, but do you kind of just reserve those, you know, those things for, like, special occasion type, you know, type outings, and, you know, like a wedding, or, you know, I have a lot of those coming up.
For me, I am tempted less and less by food that isn't going to make me feel good. So over time, I would say that being in situations where I've tested the waters has added up to my ability to not want to do that. So I don't know that you can skip that middle step. In other words, I would not be as pure as I am in terms of my food choices, which is not to say that I'm pure. Very careful words there, as pure as I am. Had I not had many times where I went ahead and had a piece of cheesecake when I was out at a big event, a party, somebody's 16th birthday party or what have you. So it's all the times that I ate the piece of cheesecake or half of it and realized I really don't like cheesecake because I don't feel good, that have allowed me to come to the place on my path. So I couldn't set a hard and fast rule, you know, once a month, once every 3 weeks. And again, I'm not the food expert here. Of course, that's Elisa. So she may have a better sense of how to answer that part of it. And yet for me, it really comes so much more out of the question of how do I feel about who I am? How much am I on my own side? So that a situation sitting there looking at something that is delicious on a table with four forks and four women doesn't look as good to me, because I really like myself more and I like the idea of waking up the next day and feeling good instead of the idea of not feeling good. So there's so many layers to this, and I think we should probably see what Elisa thinks.
Oh, well, I think you guys have started a great conversation, and I think it's tough because we want to go out to eat and we want to feel like we're part of the group. Just to reiterate what you said, Donna, I think the group can be a lot more understanding than we give ourselves credit for. I think also, too, the second thing we should stop doing as women is to stop apologizing before we even order our food, because I know in our heads we're prefacing each order with, I'm sorry, but I have an allergy, or I'm sorry, but I can't eat this food. From a psychological perspective, we definitely need to stop being so apologetic, because we're being really proactive and strong women after for basically starting on this path. So don't ever apologize when you're at a restaurant. You can certainly say thank you and I appreciate it, but that's one thing I've been working on recently, is just simply not apologizing when it's not necessary. I hope that doesn't sound harsh. Do you know what I mean, Stephanie and Donna, when I say that?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, good. Yeah, be confident in who you are. You're probably setting a great example to others around you, so don't hide from that. And I think when it comes to balance and when to go out, I think what we've been trying to mention all night, and I think clearly the stress of the anxiety, I think, is far worse than any ounce of gluten or dairy that might find its way into your meal by accident. I think the stress and anxiety that we put on ourselves is going to exacerbate anything far beyond what, you know, a slip-up may do. Does that make sense? I think we need to control what we can control. And certainly when we get to the restaurant, we make the choice that we feel we're going to thrive off of. But we also can let things go and say, hey, I don't know if I just had a little bit of dairy. I hope I didn't, but I'm just going to go ahead and trust that my body will heal. My body will, you know, become my greatest asset in this healing journey. and that it's really durable and it will find homeostasis. So I think just letting go a little bit is going to give you a lot of longevity in this journey when it comes to eating out or being at a family event, you know?
I agree, and I think aside from life-threatening food allergies, experience is a great teacher, and so you have a little bit of this or that. Personally, my mother-in-law, Spanakopita, is not to be missed. And so, you know, there are certain things that we do that we're not going to do every day, and I think that that's really okay. And as time goes by, we'll learn how far we want to go with having foods that we don't normally have. And I agree. I think our body will teach us. There are also little tricks, and Elisa knows these better than I do. But I take probiotics with me to restaurants, and I will often I have a little kind of digestive powder that I use when I'm at a restaurant, and if I'm with a good friend, I pour some in a glass and stir it up and drink it. And I was with a friend in New York on business last week, and she asked me if I had any and poured it in her glass of water and drank it. So, you know, it depends which friend you're with.
Yeah. Absolutely. Stephanie, does that help you with your questions?
Yes, absolutely. And it de-stressed me as I'm sitting here listening to it. So it just made me think everything is going to be okay. So thank you.
Good.
Absolutely. Thank you, Stephanie, for your questions. They were great. And I think everyone benefited from them for sure. Okay, we have one more question. It's from Virginia. I believe it's Sarah. So if you want to jump on the phone, Sarah, just put *7 to talk, and we can take your question.
Hey, Elisa. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
Hey. Thank you so much for being here. You know, listening to you talk has, like Stephanie said, been a huge inspiration for me. And I also watched your YouTube video with Elisa earlier today, and had many aha moments during both watching that and this call. So thank you so much. And this call is just very timely for me. I feel like I'm someone who just walks through life who is constantly stressed out. And like you said on the YouTube video, I just feel like a bear is going to attack me at any minute, whether it's, you know, in my job or in school or with my family and stuff like that. So I keep hearing this word meditation, but I guess I am someone who is just a complete beginner and would just love some tips on how to get started. I assume you were a beginner at it once too, and it's definitely something I would love to bring into my life. But I guess, like I said on the Facebook forum, I'm someone who just cannot turn off my brain. I can't even turn off my brain in yoga. So I guess that's sort of stirred me away from meditation, not thinking that I would, I guess, be very good at it. Clearly, I beat myself up a bunch, too. So any tips on the meditation would be really helpful, just to how to get started.
Well, I'm a big believer in going to someone who can help me. And I say that pretty much in every aspect of life. So when I wanted to learn how to meditate, I made sure, you know, I did quite a bit of research on what different courses might be good for me. Of course, all of a sudden, I had almost too many choices because there's Buddhist meditation and secular meditation, and in Buddhist meditation there are about 500 different types and sects of meditation, and you know there's a whole school that comes out of Tibet and a whole school that comes out of different, every country has its own. So I was pretty much overwhelmed, and then I really asked myself, well, what do I want from this? And it turns out that really what I wanted was to get back on the Life Channel and to be in a place where I didn't feel like illness was my joy thief, and to be in a place where I was really experiencing joy again. And to me, that meant quieting the mind, quieting the stress state. And that led me to the work of Jon Kabat-Zinn, coming out of Mass General up at Harvard, where he had developed the mindfulness-based stress reduction program and tested it on hundreds of thousands of patients and found that they really, in very, very carefully done studies, were coming to a place where symptoms of stress and anxiety, depression, pain, everything that we don't enjoy feeling was going down. People were able to manage it. They felt better about their lives. And this research has been repeated by many different researchers now around the world. So I found someone locally who taught a stress reduction program at Johns Hopkins. Often these courses are taught at local hospitals, community centers, yoga studios. It's not that hard to find a course near you. And as I said earlier in the call, the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program, MBSR, which is the most well-studied stress reduction program that exists, and I don't get paid for saying that. By the way, I have no affiliation with them whatsoever. They now added an online program for the first time just in the past 2 months, which is really exciting. So I would send anyone there. It's affordable. It's something that you can do in many different times of day. There are some people have weekend courses. Some have online courses that you can do as you like. That's really where I would send you because it worked for me. And I was no easy case. And I knew nothing about meditation. I had no clue if I even wanted to do it or if it would work for me. But I found the steps that are taught through this course are broken down so beautifully, and there are so many options for practice, so many tools that this course can put in your toolkit, that I use them intermittently all the time in my day-to-day life now.
Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Thank you.
So I wish I could teach you how to meditate right now, but I couldn't.
I wish you could too.
I will tell you a couple of my favorite websites where you could download a meditation when we get off the phone. One is Tara Brock. Mm-hmm. Is a wonderful teacher of meditation. She gives a very, very clear guided meditation that you can try. Another is Jack Kornfield. And if you simply Google Tara Brock Meditation Podcast, it will lead you to her website. It will lead you to her on Dharma Seed. If you do the same thing with Jack Kornfield, those are just some. Sylvia Borstein, Sharon Salzberg, those are probably my four favorite.
Okay, great. I'm already Googling it. This is awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Awesome question. And thank you, Sarah, for speaking up and, inquiring about that. I think, Donna, you did a great job explaining it. I wish I, too, could explain how to meditate in our time together. But the resources we're going to provide you guys will be very comprehensive. Actually, I'm putting together the email tonight for you guys, and it will list all of the websites that Donna just mentioned and a few more that I know we both like. So don't worry. Tonight you'll have a whole list of great resources to check out. Okay, is there anybody else here on the call tonight who has a question and wants to jump on the call and talk? We do have a few more minutes for questions, so if you are listening and you want to throw out a question, just press star 2 to raise your hand, and we'll be happy to talk. Okay, it looks like no more questions. So what I'm going to do is just kind of wrap up and, again, let everyone know what's going to happen tonight and tomorrow. I'll be sending out an email with, my team will be putting together a really comprehensive list of resources for you and even a recommended reading list, which I've been meaning to do. And, of course, The Last Best Cure will be at the top of the list of recommended reading. And I'm going to put Donna's website on the email as well tonight. So you'll have everything you need to kind of take this call and take everything that we talked about and begin to dive a little bit deeper at your comfort level. And secondly, I just want to thank you, Donna, again, for taking the time with us and for, educating and inspiring us all to keep keep continuing to be on this path. I think that, you know, the work you do is phenomenal, and I really appreciate you being here. You're an expert, and it clearly shows, so thank you again for coming.
Such a great pleasure to be here, Lisa. Thanks for everything you do for patients. I learn a lot from you, and so I was happy to be included, and thanks for all your great listeners.
Awesome. Great. So anybody else have any questions, please feel free to post them to the message board on Facebook. Obviously not too late because we're all going to be mindful of getting to bed this week. I know that's part of our journey. And just a couple of reminders again, since I have you all live, our recipe contest will be finished. The recipes need to be submitted by this Saturday, so I'm extending the deadline for those of you who want to win a cookbook. And then the other reminder is that we do have a bonus class this Sunday, which will help you understand how you can take everything you've learned and continue to apply it into your life and how I can help you in that process. So definitely tune in for the emails this week and also the bonus class that we have this coming Sunday. And remember to take it one day at a time, to be your best coach, and to just be patient and kind to yourself along the way. And you're going to find more success than you ever dreamed you could find. And it's going to be a great journey. So thank you again, guys, for tuning in. Get some rest tonight, and we will connect via email and the internet soon. Okay, take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, Donna.
Thank you.